Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hey, folks. It was a surprise to me, and it's going to be a surprise to you. You know that this is a podcast from SBGAN that's billed as presenting the work of Dr. Warren Heyer, who is a consultant pediatric gastroenterologist at St. Mark's Hospital, that is to say at the polyposis and bowel disease mecca of the British Isles. But when he showed up with, with somebody for tag team podcasting. And I won't tell you whether it's a he, I won't tell you whether it's a she. He or she will just come on at the appropriate moment in this podcast. But we'll start with Dr. Heyer. Warren, you've been 30 years at the business end of a scope. And you've done an awful lot of work in polyposis syndromes and in working out how they are best to be managed from a gastroenterology, oncology, endoscopy perspective. Indeed, you gave us a set of guidelines 4 years ago, published in JPGN, for a number of such conditions. What's changed since?
Fortunately, not a lot has changed, except they've been used much more widely. These guidelines took probably a decade to come together, and they were based on adult practice that needed to be transferred into the pediatric arena.
But these are pediatric disorders.
Well, I would challenge that, if I may. These are principally adult conditions which have previously been managed by adult clinicians. And it's been in the last two decades that, with the help of SBGAN, we have brought this into the pediatric sector. And that's a game changer. These children would turn up often in an adult clinic with a parent, because many of them are familial or inherited conditions.
Sure.
And they would get a pretty rough deal out of an adult doctor who's not used to assessing a three-year-old or an eight-year-old or a 12-year-old. So the work of producing these guidelines is the end point of bringing pediatric gastroenterology into the world of polyposis.
Understood. It's remarkable how once you have the MD after your name, you think you can handle anything, even if it's 3 years old.
So this is now developed because we had created probably what was the world's first polyposis clinic in 2004, a pediatric polyposis clinic out of St. Mark's. And we used that institution because it remains the oldest but the largest polyposis registry in the world. So we have still to date hundreds of families who are having children predicted to be at risk of polyposis. And by collecting data and looking at adult practice over a period of two decades, it became clear what was the preferred treatment path, endoscopic assessment, time of screening, and taking this information, we created guidelines incorporating both North American and European pediatric gastroenterologists.
But these guidelines now, from what I understand, were at the moment they were promulgated, rather wisps in clouds. They were extrapolated rather than confirmed.
So I'm going to challenge that, because backing this is data and information showing that the ages that we start surveillance and the method by which we screen these children is effective. And I'll prove that to you.
No. I'm not questioning that they're now proven as effective. I'm just saying that when you put them out there, were they?
They were more consensus by nature, based on data that we had collected prospectively over a 20-year period.
We knew before
the introduction of Peirce-Jaeger guidance that about 70% of these children would have a laparotomy before they were 18. We had that historical data. But by knowing when we had introduced screening and surveillance, by the time we wrote the guidelines, we knew we had brought that figure down to probably less than 5%. So we did not publish these guidelines based on a whim. We published them based on extensive experience, principally out of large polyposis units mainly at St. Mark's, but also in the US and other polyposis units around the world.
From 80% to 5%.
That was the figure for Peutz-Jeghers.
Still, that's a stunning.
Well, that's fortunately the outcome of well-organized surveillance. And we are privileged that those who work in polyposis work in family clinics, often with a registry, prospectively calling children up for surveillance.
So there's always a new crop of kids, and there's always somebody to be checked out.
There is, because remember, for all of these polyposis syndromes, about 20 to 30% of them are new mutations.
Uh-huh.
So even if we try and introduce surveillance and screening as addressed by the guidelines, there will still be new families who are new manifestations who will fit outside those guidance and may present in emergency or may present even with colorectal cancers. But the guidelines was principally developed for those who were new diagnoses who entered screening and surveillance programs. And they have stood the test of time over those 5 years.
What can I say except what an accomplishment?
Well, it wasn't just me. It's a cohort of probably over a dozen authors in each of the papers. And it was slow in its evolution, took about 2 years to come to its fruition, but has been adopted and cross-checked with the adult guidance from other institutions around the world, such as the Insight Group, which is an inheritable cancer group who work alongside our polyposis team. They've been ratified by the North Americans and other institutions around the world. And we know that they match the adult guidance, but are pediatrically flavored, and therefore they work well.
And you spearheaded that.
I spearheaded it with St. Mark's Polyposis Services behind me, but with all the international collaborators that joined us, particularly my co-chair, who is Shlomi Cohen.
I'm going to ask you, if it isn't telling tales out of school, what took 2 years to hammer out a compromise that was acceptable to others? Where were the points of conflict?
So we were starting from nothing. There were no pediatric guidances that had ever been generated. There were areas of controversy. The main areas of controversy might be in Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, where we suggested that screening could start at age 8 years. Perhaps that was too late. There was controversy about the frequency of colonoscopy in children with familial adenomatous polyposis and the frequency in juvenile polyposis. And we addressed those in the guidelines and have subsequently generated publications in JPGM, which have validated what we've seen, that we can personalize the frequency of endoscopic surveillance for all of the conditions, all three of the major polyposis syndromes. We can personalize it based on evidence that we've now created in the last 4 to 5 years.
But that evidence has been complemented not just by, we tried it, we saw, and it looks as if it worked out. It's been extended as well. You've been doing genetic work.
Fundamentally, all the guidance has looked at genotype-phenotype correlation. That's less important in Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, but certainly important in familial adenomatous polyposis. What we weren't clear about is the relationship between genotype, or the presence of a disease-causing variant, and juvenile polyposis. And this has just come to fruition, and a paper that's now due to be published is specifically looking at the genotype and phenotype correlation in children with juvenile polyposis who don't have a disease-causing variant.
Okay, look, listeners at home, it's going to be in JPGN. Watch out for it. Listeners at home, JPGN is the journal. Watch out for it.
This study, which is the largest of its kind, has subsequently proven that those children who don't have a disease-causing variant, they probably need less colonoscopies less often and make less polyps. And potentially in the next decades, we may find that they don't carry the same malignancy risk that the juvenile polyposis has previously incurred in all patients who made multiple hamartomatous polyps. So we're going to be able to personalize over the next decade how to manage these children and how to survey them for cancer conditions as they get older. This is a game changer.
That is indeed a game changer. And that in only 5 years. I happen to have with me a crystal ball. Would you mind looking into it and saying where we're going to go next?
First stage is we have to ensure that standards of care are unified and of high quality across the whole of Europe and the world. That's required a big educational drive, to which we're very grateful to Espagan and Naspagan. And polyposis is now frequently presented in all of the international meetings. It's gone from what was a fringe condition for adult doctors to an integral part of pediatrics and pediatric endoscopy. So the first crystal ball will be improvement in standards of care. The second crystal ball is that everyone will want to be registered with a polyposis registry for the multidisciplinary care and the access to the specialist nurses.
Wait, stop. Something's swimming up in the crystal ball. Why, it's Fiona Carroll-Marin. Sorry, it's Fiona Cargill-Marin. And you are our mystery guest.
I am indeed.
Okay, and what is your line of work, ma'am?
I am a pediatric gastroenterology nurse specialist in polyposis that works with Dr. Heyer at St. Mark's.
Tell us the kind of difference that you make to the care of the families, I want to say families, that are affected by this condition. It might just be one child, but the parents, the grandmothers, the great aunts, they're all involved and they all show up in your office.
Exactly. We're able to work very closely with the entire family and give them extra care, extra time that they need. We've got advice lines if they've got any concerns, queries, able to educate them. I work with my colleague Jackie Hawkins, who also has clinics. We do weekly clinics. We bring patients in. We can provide the genetic counselling. We can follow up the patients. We're able to liaise and work very closely also with our adult colleagues, help them also prepare for the
transition,
adulthood.
Yeah, exactly. Young adult care, yes.
And the adult care. And we can work very closely with our adult team in order to provide that very good standard of care that they deserve for a condition that's going to be with them their entire life.
How many programs like yours and Dr. Heyer's are there?
I'm not very sure if there's many others. Well,
where's your working group? Where's your society? Where's your badge? Where's your identifying tattoo?
Oh.
So St. Mark's Hospital was the first institution in the world to have a dedicated pediatric polyposis nurse. We think there's probably only half a dozen of them around the world.
Well, I guess it's like having a party card with a number in one digit. You're there.
Feel very lucky.
And where are some of these places that have adopted this method and gone for this coordinated and extended care? Some other institutions that you know of.
So we know that these institutions, they're based around Europe and in North America. And if children are integrated into a polyposis registry, we know that their outcomes are better. Their chance of developing cancer is lower. This is work that's been published over 15 years ago, but still true to today, that the quality of the screening, surveillance, and managing of complications as they get older seamlessly into adult care improves their survival to much closer to the normal survival for an unaffected person. Surveillance works.
I'm not questioning that it works. I'm just asking, how widespread is it? And with the follow-up, of course, the corollary of why ain't it done more often?
So there are easy reasons in Europe why it's adopted. There are numerous very world-famous and high-quality polyposis registries throughout Europe. And there are also some in North America, highlighting some really well-established international centres, of which the most famous must be the Cleveland Clinic, which works in parallel with St. Mark's. We know that patients who are part of these institutions of care will have better outcomes. Now, not everybody is going to have a local polyposis registry. It's a bit easier, for example, in the UK. We're one island and we have one nationalised healthcare system. But it's no doubt that in environments where healthcare is more fragmented, it may be harder to transition a patient out of pediatrics to adult care. There may not be an adult registry adjacent to that pediatric gastro unit. So it's harder in some areas than we have find in our own institution, where we cohabit and live in exactly the same clinic space as the adult gastroenterologists and adult colorectal surgeons who look after patients with polyposis syndromes.
It sounds as if you need to do outreach, not just to patients, not just to patients' families, but to the individual members of ESPGHAN who are located away from such medical centers and who need to be counseled, helped, handled along as they deal with patients such as this. If I live in Hungary and the closest medical center is in a town 20 kilometers north of me called Szombathely, and I'm sure there's no such registry there. If somebody from inside, hello, people in Szombathely, are you listening? Is Dr. Heyer, are you ready to point these people to some place where they can be helped? Are you ready to do the helping yourselves?
So this is actually already in place. ESPGHAN has championed the educational program of polyposis, and we've had a space in the program for the last 5 years. And we have a very effective special interest group where there are numerous people from multiple countries. We've probably got 50 working colleagues within the special interest group, which is likely to cover the majority of the European countries. And they will have access to these guidelines, and they have access to all of us. But there is still change afoot. Many countries are developing rare disease clinical networks. They're now the new way of delivering care, where you don't actually coexist close to the registry. This happens throughout America, and it happens throughout the UK, where centres beyond St. Mark's can access clinicians by video or by consultation or by sending the patient to that knowledge base that's been developed throughout the polyposis families.
Brilliant.
That's also been spilled out into Europe. Be confident, ESPGHAN have really spread the word on how to manage this, and it's managed to publish, assist us in the publication of all of these guidance, which is now available globally. And we know they're being used because we see the metrics from JPGN. These are popular guidelines.
I am very pleased to hear about all of this. And saddened a little bit that we've run out of time. Now, at this juncture, we generally offer the person being interviewed a chance to share with us a song, something that reflects his or her love for his or her own country, and we'll point that up for us. So, no, not you, not you. You've done enough talking. Fiona, what song do you want to recommend to us?
Okay, I think I'm going to go for Dancing Queen.
Dancing Queen by ABBA.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, ESPGHAN's Favorite Songs.
Thank you, Fiona, and thank you, Warren.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.